Joining me today is somebody that, I'm not going to lie, has I've been pestered to get him on one of the early shows by the first appearance, Daryl Baxter. He's a ex-developer turned writer and somebody that I have been rereading his books, because I'd actually read books without even realizing he was even on a podcast with Daryl. You may know him from producing stuff on his iPad, but it's of course the great Matt Gemmell. How are you doing, Matt?
I'm not bad, Greg. Thanks so much for the invitation. It's great to be here.
It's always good. I'm getting to the stage where I do probably far too many podcasts, but getting people on seems to be more difficult than need be, because there's just far too many people and barely get replies. But it was very nice of you to respond and kind of jump at the chance straight away.
I was very, very eager to, and it's also handy that we're in the same time zone. That's a relatively rare thing for me when I'm appearing on a podcast.
Tell me about it. Yeah, I've had to do some strange times for podcasts. Yeah, it's not ideal, but I guess it's possibly the worst time of year to do one.
Yeah, it's pretty sort of miserable to be sitting inside the curtains drawn and the darkness outside and the cold and you're talking to someone in a time zone where it's nice and sunny instead.
Yeah, I suppose that's even worse. Yeah, I suppose it could be 5 o'clock in the morning, because I've done that before.
Ouch. Well, just don't Skype me again when it is 5 o'clock in the morning, all right?
No, not by accident, no. So you're fresh off the release of your second book.
That's right. It was just last Wednesday that it finally came out.
It seemed like it took forever to come out, and it was the first ebook I've ever pre-ordered.
Wow, I'm extremely honoured. Thank you.
I tweeted at you. I was just like, "Oh, it's coming out soon. I best pre-order." I don't really see the. I guess there's no real need to pre-order an ebook, but I quite often see stuff and think, oh, it comes out in a couple of months, and then forget about it. And then it's only when I'm searching around for something to read that I eventually do it. So I guess it makes sense. You just get a nice little email from Amazon that says, I suppose other ebook providers are available, but an email from Amazon that says, your book's arrived.
Yeah, it's like a nice wee digital surprise parcel showing up. Yes, indeed. I'm quite bad for pre-ordering things, and indeed just buying books that are already available and they sit on the Kindle, and it's only when the next holiday comes round or lazy weekend that I suddenly find I've got this huge backlog.
Yeah, I'd read the first book. There was a reasonable gap between the two, I guess, wasn't there? But I read the first book a while ago, a few months ago anyway, and I really, really enjoyed it. I mean, it's...
thank you.
I guess it pulls on those kind of technology strings that we both kind of circle around those sorts of people on Twitter, but... I've read a lot of the Ben Hope books. Is it Scott?
Mariani, yes.
That's him.
The Ben Hope series myself, yeah.
Yeah, which, to be honest with you, that your books is written in a similar sort of flow. It's almost got the same sort of patterns to the words and stuff, and he's very descriptive, and I think you are certainly try to purvey that sort of writing style as well.
I think there's definitely a similarity there, yeah. I mean, a certain type of language lends itself to the kind of action thrillers in the case of the Ben Hope books, and sort of slightly more on the techno-thriller side for my stuff. You tend to have that, you tend to have exotic locations, so you're being quite descriptive anyway, but you also have the fast pace and the quick cuts and the cliffhanger chapter endings and all that sort of thing, all that good stuff.
Yes, yeah, definitely. You, I mean, some of the locations and stuff that you go into really sort of in-depth detail. What sort of research did you do? Did you go on location? Could you convince the wife to accompany you to all these places?
The truth is that it's usually my good lady who convinces me to go on holiday. I'm one of these sort of home in the cave sort of people, and she convinces me to go to these fantastic places with her, and then they end up absolutely being the settings for scenes in the books. So I've fortunately been to most of the locations in the new novel that just came out, which is called Toll.
Yes.
T-O-L-L. And There are a few that I haven't. I guess they'll be pretty obvious to anyone who reads the book. But yeah, I've thankfully a lot of those descriptions are from my own memory.
From your own memories, you didn't kind of make notes and stuff while you were there?
Occasionally I do that. And if I find something that I just know is going to be in the book, and you're taking photos since you're on holiday anyway. But quite often what I do is just sort of experience it, walk around, let it sort of filter away into the subconscious and then come back to it later and describe it as I remember it, because it tends to be a sort of a brighter, slightly more exaggerated, slightly sort of better suited for fiction version, you know, than being too accurate to real life all the time.
Right. Okay. I presume that Scott does loads of research into guns and all those sorts of stuff. So I was thinking that you might have been in those sort of situations as well.
In terms of all the guns and the weapons and stuff, there's a huge amount of research involved. The techno thriller genre is so much fun. I loved reading it. I love writing in that genre. But the research burden is enormous, particularly since the focus of my series, the series is called Kestrel. The new book, as I said, is called Toll. The first one that you read is called Changer. And as you know, they're very EU-focused, so we've got lots of lovely settings in Europe and all the languages as well. So it's an awful lot of architecture and history and different languages and time zones, travel times, weather conditions at different times of year. You've got to put all that stuff together and make the timeline actually work, because if you don't, someone will notice and they will send you an email about it.
You'll have all those nerds to deal with. I mean, they get a lot of bad rep for like comic book movies, but I'm guessing those sorts of people exist. But it's barely like, it's not the fault of your own, is it? Because I guess you distribute it out to fresh eyes and they kind of do all the mapping out and stuff for you as well.
I'm fortunate that I do indeed have various sort of people, from editing to proofreading to beta reading, as we call it these days. And that's for you get different types of people. Some of them are great at spotting the typos, and some really do go deep on the research. They will look up everything that you mention on Wikipedia and correct your, you know, date of this and so on, which is fabulous. It's humbling as well, right enough.
Yeah, true.
But it's a fantastic resource to have.
When I spoke to Daryl, he said that obviously he had to finish reading it because he was part of your like exclusive whatever, and he had to finish reading it on his MacBook because obviously he'd sold his iPad. I was like, I wondered why you were trying to finish a book. I thought it was a bit strange at the time.
Yeah, did he get the smaller iPad and then decide on the bigger one, and he had to wait to get it or something?
He had to wait for his iPad, but sold his 10.5-inch one in the process. And I think there was about a month where he was iPadless. I mean, Daryl was on the last episode of the podcast, and if there's one thing that Daryl loves, it's iPads. So he must have just felt like a bit of him was missing for quite a while.
Indeed, I think he was feeling very deprived, but he's got his new toy now, so he seems happy.
Very true. So you wrote the whole of both of the books on an iPad Pro?
Just the second one. Was written back in the heady days of my MacBook usage. I switched after that sort of, 2 or 3 years ago now. And the entirety of the newest book was indeed written on the iPad in Ulysses.
Yeah, I read the post the other day. I didn't realise you could actually do half of the stuff in Ulysses that you could do. I mean, obviously, I've used it in the past and kind of pitched its usefulness to other people. But you've gone to like a whole new level with obviously custom layouts and all that sorts of stuff. I guess it must be really, really easy to do it on the iPad with all sorts of automation and stuff going on as well.
Yeah, Ulysses is one of these apps that looks extremely Spartan, but there are hidden depths there. There's just enough extra stuff behind the scenes to let me do the various things I need to do. I mean, obviously sitting writing 100,000 odd words is only one part of it. There's an awful lot of planning and research, as I said, and organising your character sheets, your locations. There's front matter and back matter for the paperbacks and the ebooks. There's loads of stuff, and Ulysses lets me organize all of that and export a pretty decent book at the end of it as well. And it is just a pleasure to use on the iPad. They've got the fantastic iCloud Sync, which is really some of the best in the business. It's just, it's absolutely seamless. So in the odd time that I'm out and about and something occurs to me, I just want to tweak something on the iPhone, I can do that no trouble at all.
True.
And if I do end up, you know, back on a Mac for any reason, obviously, you know, it's absolutely macOS supporting as well. And it's essentially an identical feature set on each platform. It really is a very impressive piece of software.
Mm. And you went even to the extent of producing the front cover and everything on the iPad as well.
I did, yeah. I use a, which was an app called...
like 24 layers of images or something.
It was a lot. Yeah, it was a big... My cover designer, like just about everyone uses Photoshop, had the same chap called Stuart Batch that did Changer and Toll's cover. He previously did the UK imprints for Stephen King and John le Carré and so on. He's really a fantastic designer. He's obviously an Adobe Creative Suite user like most people, and we are getting full Photoshop on the iPad next year, but Affinity Photo, a fantastic app that's on iOS and on the Mac as well, does a fantastic job of reading Photoshop PSD files, and that's what I use to create the full cover wraparounds for the paperbacks, because obviously you need front cover and spine and back cover as well.
Yeah.
Position for the barcode, the blurb, the reviews, blah, blah, blah. And I did all that on the iPad with the Apple Pencil.
Yeah, all of these people that think you can't do anything, or what was that tweet from Tom Warren, something about all people do is fart about and send emails. It's just laughable, really, isn't it? When you're going to the just as in depth as anything I've ever seen on the iPad to produce proper content. I mean, you're not typing words into a CMS. You're producing an actual book, which is actually crazy to even think about that you're doing it on what most people consider as a consumption device.
Yeah, I think people just aren't aware of the depth of some of the apps that are available out there. The platform has always been very well served by these excellent software houses like Panic and Barebones and Omni Group. Of course, Ulysses at the company as well now. There's Scrivener, the other huge writing app that's primarily a Mac app. It's on iOS as well as also Windows version. You can do some incredible things on the iPad, and in most cases it's just that people either aren't aware of that or aren't willing to make the mental shift to a very different interaction.
It's definitely a paradigm shift, isn't it?
It is.
A lot of things. I mean, I was thinking the other day, something as simple as like rotating a PDF. You kind of Google it and there's no real answer. You have to do a little bit of digging, and of course you can do it with an app or a couple of apps, and you can do most things, but it's definitely a sort of paradigm shift which takes a little bit of getting your head wrapped around it. I mean, I've been using an iPad for my quote-unquote computer for 3 or 4 years now, and it's amazing what you can get done, and certainly even over the last couple of years, it's really been turbocharged where developers are really pushing the platform forward and finding out what it can do. I mean, obviously shortcuts and things like that help as well, but it's kind of just laughable to see what people think is real work. And you've obviously gone from start to finish publishing a novel. What did you say it was, 100,000 words?
Just shy of that, yeah. When you include what I do is when people finish the book, they can sign up for a newsletter, and if they do, they get a bonus chapter. So when you include that in, it is just over 100,000 words, which is a serious amount of writing.
Yeah, a ridiculous amount of writing. I guess you've always been used to typing things out in one stage or another, but you switched from, I would guess, a pretty lucrative career in software development to write. What on earth motivated the choice? Most people go the other way. They're kind of like messing around writing and learn code and start doing that. And not, I would have never thought, I mean, you work for some pretty high up there companies at one time or another, didn't you?
I did, yeah. My sort of pathway through education was very much towards computing science. I did write fiction just in my teenage years, as I think a lot of people do at that age, and loved it. And I read a lot. Vaguely planned for it to become a career, but that sort of just fell by the wayside in the face of going through high school and, you know, the university entrance exams and getting a degree. So my degree was in computing science from Glasgow. It's where I met my wife as well, actually. And then I became a sort of consultant software engineer, mainly focusing on the user interface and interaction design usability side of things.
Right, yeah.
And it was, as I say, on a consultancy basis. So I did a lot of work for Apple and some other big companies, just running my own business doing that. On the side of that, in the last number of years of you know, my time doing that, I started doing a bit of technology journalism. And that was what was, it was kind of like a sort of way back to writing by stealth almost, because it was tech and it was sort of off the back of the blog, and it was for various magazines, newspapers, websites and things. Mm-hmm. And it was that that reawakened my love of writing and made me remember how much I'd loved writing fiction when I was a wee lad. And I sort of thought, you know, I actually really, really like this, and I probably like it a bit more than the writing code. So before I get any older, I'm going to really try and do this. And that's pretty much what prompted the switch.
Really? It's amazing that you would, I guess it would have been a pretty scary sacrifice to go from something like that to a world where you're not really sure. I mean, I'm not entirely sure I understand what it must be like being a writer. I guess you just have to give yourself sort of self-imposed limits, do you, to produce the book?
Oh, very much. Yeah, it was absolutely terrifying, completely, because
I just can't imagine I mean, it would scare me to death just having the thought about it when you're going from working that.
I think you're in the majority there, yeah.
Yeah.
The previous sort of the business that I was running was... It was lucrative. It was very comfortable.
Yep.
A lot of it, eventually, of course, it channeled mostly to iOS, the huge, you know,
yes,
the platform that was very much for the masses and hugely successful and very much focusing on intuitive interfaces and good user experience. And that was what most of the work was, and there was loads of work. So it wasn't ever a question of any of that, you know, drying up at all. It was...
Yeah. So you kind of transitioned over, did you? Just kind of wound it down, so to speak?
A slight winding down towards a cliff edge at the end when it just jumps, to be honest.
I guess it gets to the stage where it's just untenable, isn't it? You can't do a bit of both.
I found, at least. It wasn't. Maybe I could have transitioned more gently in terms of splitting my time, but my motivation was there, and I'd sort of emotionally made the switch already, and I just wanted to commit to it. Whether that was selfish or reckless or whatever, I mean, I guess there's an argument either way, but I'm very glad that I just sort of made the jump.
And did you have kind of like an idea for a novel in mind?
Yeah, I had a number of ideas. The thing is that when you read a lot, and particularly when you then tell yourself, okay, I'm going to write, what I found is that you just sort of get into this mental mode whereby you notice things and they become ideas. And there's never any shortage of them. There's loads and loads and loads. And the best advice I can give to people is always write down an idea when you have it, no matter where you are. Just get it jotted down. No matter how silly or bizarre or crap you think it is, just get it noted down, because you can always use these things at some point in some way. So
yeah,
I had plenty of ideas.
Yeah, I was listening to a podcast by The Minimalist, and Joshua Fields Milburn, he was probably paraphrasing somebody else, to be fair, and he was saying, like, the best advice to start writing is just to sit in the chair, is to literally see where the idea goes, and if the idea goes nowhere, then it's just you've enjoyed the process of writing, and if the idea goes somewhere, then you enjoy the act of kind of publishing it and see what people think.
I think there's a lot of truth to that, yeah. Sort of part of the sort of daily workout for writing is to just sort of try and write something new, something short. Doesn't particularly have to go anywhere, but just as a little sort of exercise, a writing exercise. And I've kind of built that into my schedule, because one of the parts of my, I guess my business now, I would say, is that my site has a sort of membership or patronage program.
Yep.
And one of the things, there are various sort of benefits to that for the people that sign up, for the kind and generous and optimistic and lovely people that sign up. There's a sort of private chat room, and they get the books first and free whenever they come out. But the main thing from my point of view is a weekly, I used to call it a newsletter, now I just call it a letter every Monday morning. And it's these days it's usually a story, just a sort of 1,000, 1,500, 2,000 words piece of original fiction, just whatever occurs to me at the time when I'm sitting down each week to write it. And I just explore something. And it's great exercise for me. And it's really, I think, interesting for the members, the people who are reading it, because it's this, it's sort of a, it's not too heavily planned, it's raw, it's pretty pure, and it's, it goes outside my usual genres, and it's built up quite an interesting archive of writing. As of next week, it'll be 200 consecutive weeks that I've done it for.
Wow. So I guess most of the times you sit down, I mean, you've said that you, if you sign up to the newsletter, you get like a little extra chapter or whatever. I guess some of the times some of those ideas get wrapped into the next novel, but I get, it's fantastic to always kind of have an avenue to put these things out on, isn't it? Because I bet even having a little idea and maybe it only develops into 1,000 or so words, somebody's going to enjoy it, aren't they?
Exactly. That's the huge privilege of it for me, because in most cases, you know, where would you publish 1,000 words? Maybe you could put it on a blog or something, but knowing that there are these people that are really interested in reading that stuff, and that gives me the motivation and the discipline to sit down and do it each week, which helps my, I mean, I hate to use the word, but my craft. You know, that sounds terribly arty and beard stroking.
It does a little bit, but I know exactly.
It is the right
word.
It comes
from a genuine place.
Yeah, it lets me practice, if you will. And it's wonderful to be able to do that. And I think you're right, it does feed into the books as well, because sometimes these things become the germs of ideas that will make it into a future novel.
So how many novels do you think Kestrel's going to develop into? Or is it going to be one of those things where you'll just keep going?
It's a common question, and the second answer is the right one. I don't have a preconceived limit. It's
I guess
not
you're
a,
already
a trilogy
planning
or a four
probably
or five.
The third or fourth or fifth book. I bet you've got loads of ideas floating around. I hate
heavily
to see the Ulysses sheets.
Oh gosh, yeah, it's many, many, many sheets in a little folder or group in Ulysses. We're heavily into the process of planning the third one at the moment, and there are fragments of ideas for at least several more. So hopefully it'll just keep going. I'm also interested in sort of a periodically writing outside of the thriller genre as well, and that's something I plan to hopefully ramp up in the latter half of 2019.
Oh, right, okay. Yeah, it's good to see that I guess the characters all develop as well, won't they? I guess Aldridge, however you pronounce it, it's one of those words where when you read a book and you pronounce it in your head.
Yeah, yeah, that's exactly how I see it in my head as well, by the way.
That's
so
all right.
And I
then.
Agree so on it.
I guess that there's some inspiration from you there, surely.
I think he's quite heavily got elements of me in him, yes. Whenever he makes one of his incredibly infuriating, like inappropriate quips in times of danger or whatever, a lot of them are stuff that I've actually come out with. And
Okay.
The main character of the series, she's called Captain Jessica Greenwood.
Yes.
And she is invariably frustrated by him.
A lot
of that frustration is really my wife.
Knows that it comes from a good place. They're kind of yin and yang, aren't they?
Very much so, yeah. There's an interesting sort of dynamic and a tension there. And we do get the chance to see a bit more of that and develop that a bit in this second book. Particularly towards the end of it, but no spoilers.
No spoilers. No, I've only just started reading the second one. I was hoping to get you were about a month or so behind. I don't know, what is it, like book 17 or something ridiculous, the Ben Hope book, and I was hoping to get that finished before I started yours. But in anticipation of obviously you podcasting with me and accepting the invite, I've started the other book. I started it a couple of nights ago, so I'm only what would that be? Probably three or four chapters in. I've noticed a real sort of you've wound in kind of your love of Apple technology in there quite well, quite subtly as well, because there's hints in there. I mean, certainly one where Greenwood is running, and there's a description in there, something about she presses the green button on her watch and accepts the call or whatever. And you can, I can already picture an Apple Watch in my head. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's something that I think when you're writing, you can't help but do. You've got your own particular image that comes from your own experiences and preferences, etc. And you have to try and keep it a little bit generic because, firstly, you need to be careful about including trademarked words.
Yes. But
also you want to allow the reader to fill in most of the picture for themselves. But I think, yeah, the more you know about a particular writer, the more of them and their life and their choices you're going to see in their work.
Yeah, you pull on your, like you were saying about the locations, your own memories and things like that, and you can't help but kind of pull your own experiences into there. But yeah, you're right. You say the book's like a just shy of 100,000 words then. So how many of those do you think you kind of deleted? Like paragraphs and paragraphs of it, or did most of it get put into the book?
In this one, most of it went in. There were a few scenes that had to come out that just weren't working. I wanted to approach them from a different sort of direction. And there were a few sort of points, potential scenes from the outline I did before I started that just didn't fit in, or they would have slowed it down or whatever. But this time it was the majority of it, distinctly unlike the first book in the series, Changer, because I didn't fully outline that or plan it before I started. I just thought I'm going to dive in. And so I got to the end of the first draft and had this horrendous, massive, traumatic rewrite of honestly the majority of it,
which was
soul-destroying. And I learned my lesson. So before starting the current one, I just outlined the whole thing, and it has been a so much nicer and smoother experience for it.
Did you? I guess that was just like a rookie mistake then. You just kind of delved in and were like, this is what a writer's supposed to do. Tappy, 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 tappy on your ridiculously clicky keyboard. And then realised towards the end, maybe that wasn't the best approach.
I think it was in large part sheer arrogance and ego.
Because that's what I would do. You know, like if I was like, I'm going to write a book, I would do what most people probably think you should do, is just start at the start and go through to the end. But obviously that's not the case when you think about it logically, is it?
It turns out, you can do that for when you're writing a couple of thousand words, but when you need to deliver on the order of 100,000 in a three-act structure and hit all the right points of tension and keep the reader engaged and all that, it turns out, surprise, surprise, there's actually a bit of sort of art and theory to it, and you need to think about it beforehand. At least you do if you're me. I'm sure there are some people that can sit down and just blast through. Good luck to them. They have my envy. But I have learned that I definitely need to plan.
Yes, and you don't want to hit a brick wall like so many authors do. I mean, we're still waiting for a Game of Thrones book when the TV series has already been produced, because I'm guessing he's just fallen out of love with it or whatever, or hit a brick wall.
I saw an interview or something. I haven't read the Song of Ice and Fire books, although I've watched bits of the TV, which I now understand diverges quite a bit or goes ahead. But my wife's a big fan of both, and she has certainly periodically expressed her frustration at waiting for the upcoming book. But honestly, the more that I've written and learned about the process and the more mistakes I've made, the more I sympathise with the man. I can kind of understand how he must be feeling, because I've been, down in that mire, the will it ever get finished kind of pit as well. So I sort of try to preach tolerance in that regard.
Yeah, we'd all love it, books to be picked up by like a TV producer or Hollywood or whatever, but when you're in a situation where they're just like, right, this one needs to be out by this date, and you're under pressure, stress is probably not the best thing for creating your craft, as you say.
I think it must suck all the joy out of it, and it turns it into too much of a job, which absolutely is. I mean, you need to treat it like a job. You touched on that earlier about discipline, and you absolutely do need to do that, and I have a very regimented day, and it's the only thing that works, because I'm someone who, the expression about the carrot and the stick, I very much need the stick.
Do you rely on people literally to tell you to do stuff?
Pretty much. I need accountability. I do it is that my wife and I have got like a shared spreadsheet with the various deadlines for a book, and there are so many steps. You have to work back from a release date, and you have to go back through when you have the paperback cover ready and the interior master, and of course you can't prepare the cover wraparound until the interior is fully done, because the word count and typography determines the page count, which determines the width of the spine, which determines the physical size of the cover wraparound, all this stuff. Then there's all the deadlines for submitting it to the various stores, so they'll all go live at the same time.
Jesus, you're triggering my anxiety just by talking about it.
I know, I know. You absolutely need this kind of ninja-level project management, which I can't do, but is my wife's personal superpower, so she keeps me on track. In large part, the reason that everyone has Tove right now is, you know, because of my wife's organisational skills. I just wrote the damn thing.
Well, thank you very much, Matt's wife. It's very enjoyable.
I'll pass that on.
Going back to the first book, I don't want to give the kind of plot away to anybody, because definitely you should buy it and consume it and stuff, but it's a pretty bizarre idea, the Changer.
Yeah, it's whenever I'm asked what the genre is, I always say sort of action techno-thriller, but with a hint of fringe science or conspiracy.
Yeah, I just did not see that coming from anywhere. Do you know what I mean?
It's a little bit out there, yeah. If anything, I would say that Toll is slightly more mainstream techno-thriller. There's still the fringe science and conspiracy element, but not quite the almost out at the edge of almost the paranormal thing that the first one has got going on. It's an idea I'd had for an awfully long time. And I just wanted to try and do it within the framework of that kind of, I guess, Scott Mariani, Ben Hope, or who would the other ones be? Certain Crichton books, Clive Cussler. I love reading all that stuff. I love the chase and the run and gun, and there's a bit of a mystery, and I love the not really knowing exactly what the real story is until further on. I love reading all that stuff, and it's great fun to write it, even though there's, as I said, a huge amount of preparation and research and putting your dominoes in order to do that. But I also love I grew up watching The X-Files and Unsolved Mysteries back before that and all that stuff, and I absolutely love it, and Twilight Zone, and I love getting those elements. I read Stephen King non-stop when I was a teenager, and Dean Koontz, and even H.P. Lovecraft, going back many, many, many decades before the 1930s. Edgar Allan Poe, of course. And I thought, well, can I do the sort of modern, chasey, city-jumping techno-thriller, but have elements of that stuff in the same way that the X-Files maybe introduced that stuff to the kind of FBI procedural almost? And that's what I tried to do. And it's a huge amount of fun. And I do plan to have, going back to the X-Files, I mean, X-Files was pretty much mostly Monster of the Week, but occasionally there'd be the overarching mythology of it with the Syndicate and the Black Oil and the colonists and all that stuff. Planned for the Kestrel series, there is that sort of overarching mythology part to it, as well as the sort of, you know, problem of the book, I suppose you would say. So I'm looking forward to developing that more in future novels and perhaps in shorter stories alongside it as well.
Oh, that'd be brilliant. Yeah, I suppose you've got quite a diverse, I guess you can call it cast, can't you, of individuals now that can develop over time and spin off short stories and all that sort of stuff. That's genuinely got me excited to get through this book now. I've only just started it, so it's going to be great.
I really hope you're going to enjoy it. I'm really happy with how it's turned out. I think that, I mean, I love Changer, the first book in the series. Everyone loves the first book, and I think it's a good, solid story. I do think that I have improved, but I guess everyone would want to think that, you know, when you've spent a few extra years doing the thing, you'd like to think you're a bit better. I think it's a better book, and it's got a slightly different slant, so it's a slightly different flavour of the Kestrel series.
It certainly feels different, even in the first little bit. It certainly feels different. You can tell it's your book, do you know what I mean? But it definitely feels different. I don't know whether... I wouldn't really say that you've... Well, it sounds really wrong to say, but I wouldn't really say you've improved. I would say they're both kind of really, really good books so far. Do you know what I mean?
Well, I mean, that's obviously the sort of feeling I want people to have. One of the joys of a series is that, as you say, you've kind of done a lot of the setup. You'd need to do a little bit of reintroduction in each one because people might come in at any point, but you've got these characters and you've got the history and you're starting to develop their background and their interrelationships. And you can have fun exploring that, jumping from one to the other, and maybe emphasizing different sets of characters in different books, and just see how it all plays out. And you sort of start automatically building up a little bit of a universe for it. And as a writer, I think it's that element that keeps it interesting for me.
Yeah, a lot of books in series that I've read have fallen down at that kind of hurdle of they rely too much on you of like you've not only read and you can also remember the backstory from previous books. I guess it's a real delicate balance, not wanting to go over the story again, but still making it accessible for people that have picked it up.
It's tough, yeah. I think that as people read series, you'll see how different authors do it, and you'll naturally feel that some ways work and some ways don't.
Mm-hmm.
You're quite right that you need to be very wary of suddenly dumping a whole lot of biography on people just to catch them up and bring them up to date. You have to do it extremely subtly. What you really have to do is not assume that they've read or remember in detail the previous books. It might be years or whatever after.
Yeah,
but
it could be.
Kind of find a narrative excuse to gently reintroduce people and their personalities and how they fit into the larger story in a way that feels not redundant to someone who absolutely knows the characters already and still provides some interest, but for someone who's new to it, it also brings them on board quickly enough. So it's absolutely a delicate balance.
Yeah, I completely know what you mean. You almost have to do it without people realizing it, don't you? You
exactly.
Like you say, find an excuse to kind of go over a little bit, but not too much.
You know, most of writing is about finding ways to do interesting things without the reader really noticing. They just have to kind of suddenly feel that something's happened, and they're feeling tension, or they're feeling happy that something's been resolved, or they've made a realization about the story, but they don't want to feel they've been led into it, because that, you know, it breaks the fourth wall, it pulls them out of the narrative. So it's all about, I think of it as speed bumps, you know, those damn things that are everywhere in Edinburgh. Bump, 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 bump.
Yes.
And they just slow you down and jerk you out of the flow of driving. And of course, they have a very important safety purpose. I am not for a minute claiming we should get rid of the speed bumps. It's simply an analogy. You don't want readers to be going through the book and then suddenly blink and look away from it and think, that was a bit rough. That was, you know, that sort of shook the suspension. I've been pulled out of the story. That's what you've got to avoid more than anything. But whilst still, you know, following actual structure and building up the excitement and having conflict and all that sort of thing, you sort of almost got to do it behind their back.
Yeah, I've spoken about that in films before. Actually, it's I guess it's probably a little bit more difficult to do in writing as well, because you see it quite often in films where, especially with product placement, you can be watching like a James Bond film and they'll make like a massive deal about a Sony Ericsson phone that completely can't do what he's doing with it. Do you know what I mean? And it kind of breaks you out of that, almost like believability. It breaks you out, like you say, of that little area where you're completely consumed in the story. And I bet it's quite easy to do when you're writing it rather than filming it.
Well, they're certainly very different media. The richness of film, and I mean, I include television in that as well. I mean, television is fantastic these days. It's in, and I think in a lot of ways it's really at its peak. There's so much you can do when you've got little visual cues, color design particularly.
Yep.
Obviously, there's all the sound design as well as the score. You can do some incredible things. I mean, one of the things I watched not too long ago was the Netflix Defenders, which is the sort of intersection of four different Marvel superheroes.
Yep. Haven't watched it. I think I watched Jessica Jones, but
yeah. So that's one of the four strands, and there's Daredevil, Luke Cage, and Iron Fist.
Iron Fist. I gave up after two or three episodes of that.
It was difficult, wasn't it? I was not sad to see that particular part of it go. But if you do get a chance to catch on just on Defenders, pay particular attention to the color design, because the way they have it set up is that every one of the four characters has got this theme color to them, and the sets are lit and even painted in terms of props and things, so that you can always tell which characters are going to be present even before you've seen anyone, just by the way the light's falling and things. And it's kind of subtly done, but once you notice it, you can't stop noticing it. And it's beautiful little things like that that you can do in a visual medium. You can also, you know, use recurring musical cues to hint as to characters' yes. motivations or connections, and you maybe only pick that up on the second watch. You can't do that in written form, but you can sort of more easily jump into a character's thoughts in, mm-hmm. in prose. So, you know, there are pros, no pun intended, and cons for each medium. You just have to find a way to try and use the art that serves what you're going to do without it being gratuitous, I suppose.
I mean, everything that you're saying is just completely not what I guess an average Joe would even consider when, like, the effort and the attention to detail you have to do when writing a sort of novel. Did you have to do a lot of, like, learning? Did you take classes? I don't know. Did you speak to other writers or whatever? It can't have been a natural sort of just you flicked a light switch and all of a sudden you were a novelist.
The truth is I didn't have any formal education in creative writing beyond, I guess, whatever right. it gets, just a high school one and yes. so on. But I did read an awful lot, and I think that if there's going to be any education for a writer, it is simply in reading. I do find a lot of it just instinctive, in that I progress according to my own gut, but I think probably the deeper truth behind that is that I've consumed so much material over the years that you kind of soak it all up. It becomes right, okay. this kind of osmotic absorption thing where you get a sense of what works. And I think, I really do think the best thing that someone who's maybe wanting to write fiction but isn't too sure can do is to read fiction in the genre that they like, but maybe read it with the eyes a bit more open. Take time to notice the things that the sort of analogous to what we were talking about there with TV and film. You watch the scene blocking and listen for the music design and look for the lighting, whatever the analogies of those are in, you know, written fiction. Yeah. Just pay a bit more attention.
Right. Okay. So there literally was like a light switch moment, I guess. But yeah, it must have happened over several years. It's it definitely helps with consume. I mean, I'm an average reader. I literally cannot fall asleep without. Doesn't matter if I read two sentences or the whole book. I have to read before I go to sleep. It's just one of the things that I've been doing for so many years. I read a lot in kind of school and then didn't do it for a little bit because it was, I don't know, it wasn't like cool to sit with your book and read. Do you know what I mean? But it's it takes some kind of, you have to kind of get into the flow of it as a reader. And so quite a lot of the times I used to kind of switch between books. I'd give up after a couple of chapters and take up another book. And it always took me a little while to kind of get into the flow of things. And I guess it must be like that as a writer. You kind of just adapt to what you enjoy and what you've read before. That makes sense.
Yeah, you kind of get those cadences, and even when you're doing something that you're focused on and you've maybe planned out and you're eager to get the story down, there are still many, many, many times when it's a slog and you need to treat it like an actual job or treat it like homework, which is the thing I say, yeah. you know, like literally you've been given these 5 maths problems to do and they need to be handed in the next morning and there's not going to be time to do it before you go into your first class, and you don't want the teacher to shout at you, so, you know, treat it like homework and put your
so
arse in the seat and get it done.
Slack off, wouldn't it?
Well, the thing with writing is that it's one of these solitary activities, usually done at home, where you've got all the comforts and the video games and Netflix and books to read and all that. You can do whatever the hell you want, so why would you write? But I think the difference between people that want to write and people that actually do is that you know, you treat it like a job and you sit down and you say, I'm not getting out of this chair until I've, you know, been here for a certain amount of time, hit a certain number of words, whatever your own metric is. You've made that honest, genuine effort to, you know, treat it like a job or like homework. And that's what gets books written. It's not this magical, wonderful, creative, artistic Mary Poppins stuff. It's,
no,
you know, bums in seats for a certain number of hours, tapping the keys until it's done.
So both of your books are self-published, am I right?
That's right, yes, indeed.
So there was no kind of super rich publishers giving you a cash advance or anything. It was literally just sitting down, typing out words, and there's no money comes in until it's in the reader's hands.
100%. If anyone sent me a cash advance, it went to someone else's account, unfortunately. It never showed up here.
Exactly do you do that? Do you know what I mean? Is it just a case of contacting people that print books or publish books?
Well, there's various ways you can do it. One of the things that's available these days is something called print on demand, whereby when someone orders a book, it is printed in response to that. So you don't actually have a stockpile or a warehouse. They just literally make the order and then the book is printed and sent out then and there. My paperbacks are available at the moment on Amazon. Might be expanding to other distributors later, but Amazon will literally print the thing when you order it. The exception is if you order an autographed copy, which people can do. I obviously have to have a stock of them because I have to physically sign it and write your name on it and a wee message and so on and send it out. But even those are printed on demand in big batches. There's actually another box of them arriving theoretically sometime in the next hour. So if you hear the doorbell in the background, then that's what that'll be.
Box of books.
Another box of books. There've been quite a few of those in the last week, let me tell you.
I bet there has, yeah. I saw the great big pile of ones you were going through signing the other day on Twitter.
Yes, that's one of the big milestones. I vividly remember doing it for Changer at the very desk I'm sitting at as I speak to you right now. And I had the chance to do it for Toll early last week and indeed through the remainder of last week as well. And again, this week. It is good fun, although it doesn't have give you a cramp in your... It's the thumb that always gets me for some reason. But it is wonderful. It's part of the sort of classic image of having written a novel, isn't it? You know, signing books.
Yeah.
And it's great. And all of those, whenever you see a pile of those books that I'm signing, those have all already been sold. And I'm, you know, writing them and they're going to be sent off. And the post office absolutely hates me because I'm
that
person
that
comes in with all these boxes. But yeah, it's good fun. And of course, what we do now as well is autographed ebooks, which
that's
is a brand new
that
thing.
That was one of the questions that I had. I mean, how did you come up with that idea? I mean, for those people that aren't familiar with this idea, Matt now will get hold of an ebook, I guess, and sign it and then send it to you. How did you come up with the idea and how exactly does it work?
Well, I can't come up with credit. Take credit for the idea because it was not mine. I can't remember what the conversation was about on Twitter, but I assume it was in relation to Toll's then upcoming release because we only started doing autographed ebooks in the last number of weeks.
Yes,
and it was a chap called Andy Nicolaides.
Yes,
on
he
Twitter.
Will be on a future episode of the podcast.
There you go. So he can corroborate what I'm saying, or indeed contradict it if I get it wrong. and he sort of, I think he sort of said, "Well, why aren't there autographed ebooks?" And this seemed like the perfect intersection of the idea of, you know, a very technology-focused workflow and having an iPad Pro with an Apple Pencil, which lets
you
write
on
the screen,
by
the way. Yeah, so basically the workflow is that I've got a sort of master copy of the beautiful high-resolution cover artwork for each book. And, you know, it's the same artwork that gets embedded into the ebooks that you find on wherever you buy my books from, Apple Books, Amazon.
So you can get them from on the Kindle and everything, can't you?
Yeah, well, they're all the stores, whether you're, you know, Kobo, Barnes & Noble, Amazon in all the countries where they do ebooks, which I think is most countries Amazon is in, Apple Books as well. You can get them directly. So I basically make a copy of that high resolution artwork. I use the Apple Pencil to write the person's name and a custom little message, and I sign it. And I do everyone, of course, myself specifically for that person. There's no copy pasting a signature. They're all done exactly as if it was a paper book. Mm-hmm. And then that cover gets fed into the sort of process that generates an ebook, and it's a custom one for you, and it gets sent to you. And people have been absolutely loving it, and I think it's fantastic.
So, for example, I wanted to get a version of it on my Kindle. Do I go to Amazon and order it?
The autographed one?
Yes.
No, you would just go directly to my site.
Go to your website.
Yeah, and that's, I'll just mention that's mattgemmell.com, and it's Gemmell with two M's and two L's.
Yeah, I was
going to
say M-A-T-T-G-E-M-E-L.com.
That's right, all the doubles. And if you go there, you'll see Toll immediately. It's screaming you in the face.
It
and
is,
you can click through and hit autograph the ebook, or e-autograph, I think is what I call it. And you can order it from there. And I can do your Kindle one or the other format, EPUB, which is the one used by pretty much everyone except the Kindle. So that's Apple Books and Sony and Barnes & Noble and Nook and Kobo, all that stuff. So you can get it for pretty much any platform, and it is just lovely. I find it particularly fantastic when you sort of turn on your e-reader, your Kindle or whatever it might be, and you see all your books listed and you've got that cover and it's signed for you right there. It's such a beautiful thing. It just gives you me a little lift each time, and I really hope that any other authors who are in control of their own ebook process will consider doing it as well, because I mean, gosh, I'd love to have signed ebooks on my own Kindle as well.
It kind of gets rid of another reason why you need paper books, doesn't it? It's kind of just a nice little personal note. It makes it feel like it almost feels like you're contributing a bit more to the publisher as well, doesn't it? It's like the good old days where you had to pick up a copy and queue in a queue and get it signed and probably pay a bit more in the process. It just feels a bit more personal, doesn't it? Like almost as if the book's written for you.
Absolutely. And I think that connection is a fantastic thing. That's one of the huge benefits of this age of massive interconnectedness, where everyone can see everyone else on social media, and you can have things like this site membership program I do, and I'm on Twitter all the time talking to people, and you can just get to know the people behind the things that you know, the things that you enjoy, whether it's, you know, books or any other kind of output. You can get a bit more of the sense of the human being behind it, and I think that's what autograph books have always been about. And being able to do it in a digital way where, you know, you're not having something shipped physically all over the world and it's, you know, you can't like spill your cup of coffee on it. Well, you can, but it wrecks your Kindle, but the ebook will be okay in the cloud. It's just such a lovely idea, and all due credit to Andy for coming up with it. It's been very popular.
I'm guessing he didn't figure out how to actually do it. It was just one of those things where it's like, why can't you do this? And then it was your responsibility to go and find out why you can't.
Exactly, yeah, and I think we went from the germ of the idea that he said on Twitter to actually having a product ready to go in, I think it was 8.5 hours or something like that.
Really?
So it was absolutely this modern, agile
the wonders
business
of
thing.
Technology, yeah.
Exactly.
I guess the good thing about things nowadays, where, like you say, where everything's all interconnected, it must give people that want to write something so many avenues to go down. I mean, I know, obviously, if you only want to produce ebooks, you can just upload a PDF or whatever to Amazon, can't you? It just gives you you can distribute to so many people at like the touch of a button. It's actually crazy nowadays, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there's a bit of setup, obviously, because there's a whole bunch of you know, your tax information and blah 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 blah.
But
you can be up and running in a day or two without any problem. And they accept so many formats that just about anyone's software can generate, including Word doc files, and they'll convert it into a pretty nice looking ebook if you don't want to do that part of it yourself. Mm. And it's given it's opened up this potential huge audience of readers to so many people that don't have the, you know, the connections or the publishing contracts or the money or the technical expertise or whatever it is, they could never have done it previously.
Say,
it's very democratizing.
Yeah, it's cutting out all of these old media companies that kind of, it's the same with music, isn't it, that just want to control all the avenues that you had to kind of go to print out in hand and go, please, sir, is my book good enough to be published? And they kind of hold all the strings, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, you also can get a lot from traditional publishing in terms of they have the connections to the bookstores and they can potentially put a lot of money behind marketing. Not that I think they necessarily always do, but they do end up holding all the strings. And of course, your royalty is very low, whereby with self-publishing, you maybe need to work a lot harder doing your marketing and building your audience and building your fans. There's loads to do there. But you have control of the process and you do get most of the proceeds, depending on how you publish it.
So no publishers made you an offer you can't refuse yet?
I've not even approached anyone at all. I'm very happy doing the self-pub thing for the moment. That's not to rule out traditional publishing in the future, mm-hmm. not at all. I may submit a manuscript at some point, but I've been very pleased with how the self-publishing has gone up till now.
Good. I've noticed a lot of the kind of more traditional publishers are asking for like a cash like injection now, or almost as if you have to kind of stump up the money for the first printing run just to see if your book's good enough. But I guess the on the flip side of that, the publishers now have to deal in like tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of books to make it worthwhile for them to even look at.
I suppose so. The truth is I'm not up to date on the state of TradPub, as it's called, at the moment. All I know is that I know a bunch of people that write. Well, the self-pub's working for me, but equally I know a bunch of people who write and want to go the TradPub route, and they're sitting on years' worth of manuscripts and none have been picked up, and they're just writing and accumulating and no one's ever reading the words. And to me, that would be a bit sort of soul-crushing, I think.
Yeah, it's quite sad, actually, to think that all that kind of creativity is just sitting somewhere waiting to... You would think you would go to a traditional publisher, perhaps it gets turned down, or it's just... They want you to change this, that, and the other, and then you publish it yourself. It seems crazy to do all that work and it not see the light of day.
It seems a very sad thing, and yet for pretty much all of the history of print publishing, I think that's been the norm. It's just exponentially more so now because of the vast number of people who want to write books now. So I think the problem's just getting worse.
Mm. Yeah, so... I'm going to completely take you away from the reading process now. I know you've got to shoot off fairly swiftly, but on your downtime, I've seen you playing on the Switch. You're like a massive gamer, I'm led to believe.
That's one of many things I have been accurately called, yes.
If you're not playing with the dog, Whiskey, you seem to be playing on the Switch, but... I kind of hate Super Smash Brothers. I can't get on with it at all. I know I'm going to offend you now because I've seen all the tweets over the last few days and you seem to be like superb at it.
Well, let me perhaps surprise you and say I think I would be very, very surprised if you find anyone who loves Super Smash Brothers who can't also honestly say that they hate the damn thing. Because I think those two things go hand in hand, because I totally hate it as well, but I also love it. And I've played just about every incarnation of it on all the Nintendo consoles way back through.
Oh, right.
And the main problem with the Switch for me is that there's something about it. I don't know whether they've made it out of some fancy plastic that has a pheromone effect, but it just makes you buy loads of games that you never bloody play. There's just something about it, that amazing form factor, and you can just slot it into the dock and it's on the TV, or click the Joy-Cons and pick it up and away you go. And the huge library of indie titles that Nintendo has finally embraced, mm-hmm. what you end up with is a backlog of like 300 games, and you've never played any of the damn things. You're assuring your wife, no, I do play it in the afternoon sometimes, but really, no, there's like 40 games I haven't touched. I will play them someday, perhaps. But it's just, there's something magical about it, but it really feels like the console I've been waiting for my entire life. It's a massive screen handheld, and the gorgeous little Joy-Cons, which I love just using totally separate one in each hand. I don't clip them together with the thing.
No.
But you can also play it on the TV if you want to. I mean, I've got a separate dock through my office, so I can literally just, lift it through or back whenever I want to. Yeah, it's a glorious thing, and it's already got such an incredible library of titles. Even the sort of main, first, second, third party, big non-indie releases, there's some incredible stuff there, including the genre-defining Zelda and Mario already.
Don't even get me started on Zelda. Zelda literally was almost to the point where I would just lose days of my life. It's just so immersive. But you're dead right, aren't you? It's one of those things where for years and years and years, I kind of wanted to play games, but I always felt like, especially now I've got a family and everything like that, I had to play them like in a separate room out the way so as I didn't disturb anybody. And that's just not the way that I enjoy playing games. But now, if I'm in that situation, I can play on the Switch, sat next to my wife that's watching TV or whatever. But if I want to play with it in that sort of situation. You just stick it in a dock. I've managed to convince my wife that my son wants one, so now we're going to have two docks in the house. So I'm going to be one of those things where it's just, oh, I can play, I can literally pick it up, play Mario Kart with my son or whatever. He's only seven. He loves all those sorts of Lego games and all sorts of stuff.
Yeah,
but I can also stick it on my TV in what's now my office, my podcasting room or whatever, and play Zelda and Smash Brothers and all those sorts of things. It really feels like this is what Nintendo's been working towards for like numerous years. You can kind of see where they were going with the Wii and the Wii U, and now I suppose technology's got to a state where they can do it.
I think you're absolutely right. I think this is the sort of long game realized for Nintendo. Plus, I think a hearty combination of good fortune and design sense and all that.
Yes.
It's just a wonderful thing. And it's kind of become the center of the living room here. I mean, I'm never actually banished to my office to play the thing. My wife encourages me to play it. She will, if I'm just sitting faffing about my phone of an evening, which is not uncommon, she'll often say, why won't you play one of these games? You know, you haven't played Octopath Traveler in a wee while. Or, I mean, last night we were playing Broken Sword, was it 5? Whatever the most recent one was that they brought out not too long ago.
Yeah, and then we're 5. Yeah, I think it's 5.
I think it's 5. And then, of course, Diablo. You know, you've got the Diablo 3, the full collection thing that Switch. We made a separate account, Nintendo account, for my wife so that we can play that, because we used to play World of Warcraft, which is electronic cocaine, and we can never go back to it because it will destroy our lives. But now we jumped into Diablo, which is pretty much almost as bad and amazing, and so many more other games. I mean, I still haven't finished the DLC for Breath of the Wild, and whilst I finished the main story in Mario Odyssey, I haven't got all the power moons. And I mean, basically, you know, I could get the Switch and a power supply and get on a rocket ship and go to an uninhabited planet and quite happily live out the rest of my life playing this backlog of bloody games.
Yeah, there's just just ridiculous amounts of games, isn't there? I will pick the Switch up, play something, and then I'm like, oh, I wonder what's been released this day. And there's quite a lot of stuff just like really affordable, isn't there? I know a lot of the like AAA titles are like 50 or 60 quid, but there's so much stuff that you can pick up for like 10 quid, 20 quid, do you know what I mean? That is playable. And I've had to buy like a ridiculously big SD card because of that fact. And they've opened up this, a bit like your publishing, I guess, they've opened up this big avenue for people to only produce through the Nintendo shop. And they don't have to worry about making cartridges and all that sort of stuff. They can get their games out much, much quicker and on a much cheaper budget, I guess.
They've done the opposite thing as well, whereby companies have sprung up that will aggregate all these orders for a digital only game and then make an order from Nintendo for a bulk package of cartridge versions of it. So,
right,
I think Limited Run Games is the name of the main one, and if you get games that are really popular in digital, they will actually order with Nintendo a whole bunch of cartridge versions, so you can get this limited release physical version, which I love, because I'm a cartridges guy.
I
grew up with them, and I love having the box, and it takes up loads of space under the TV, and it's silly, but I just love having the physical thing. But I've also got loads of the digital ones, and the problem is, as you say, there's loads of them for under a tenner, and you say, well, I can't spend 60 quid on this new AAA title, but I can happily spend 6 or 7 or 8 times a tenner on all these affordable games, and suddenly you realise you've spent even more money. Oh.
I never just add money onto my Nintendo account. It's always exact amount on the credit card, because otherwise I've got a little bit of money here. I would just literally search around to buy that. It's like digital crack, isn't it? It's ridiculous.
Yeah, I've started to develop an aversion response to that little dee-dee-dee-dee noise in the eShop, and you've just confirmed a purchase, you know, and I'm like turning the volume down. I hope my wife doesn't realise what that noise means.
Why is there 30 transactions from the Nintendo store yesterday?
Yep. Definitely just filter those straight to this spam folder.
Oh, God.
No, it's a magnificent machine, though, and there's so many excellent titles coming out next year, particularly the one that's going to bring an end to my writing career and an end to my even leaving the house at all career, which is Animal Crossing, the other thing that was my digital crack back in the day. And that's coming out for the Switch, and it's just going to destroy me. But I will go willingly into the night because I am desperate to play it.
So you heard it here first, folks. There is no more Kestrel books, unfortunately.
That's it. Matt, it's just Animal Crossing fan fiction from now on. Whatever that Animal one looks like.
I wouldn't.
I'm sure it exists.
Don't search
for it on Google. It's probably a thing.
don't search for Animal Crossing fanfiction. It definitely exists. If there's a game or a TV show or a film or whatever, there's definitely fanfiction written about it, isn't there?
I'm sure. And that's a wonderful thing. It's great. It's a wonderful creative medium. But Animal Crossing might be a wee bit far. But, you know, whatever your tastes are, you do you.
Yep.
It's fine.
Whatever floats your boat, yeah. I'll write the Kestrel books. You write the fanfiction.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right, it's been awesome to talk to you for just over an hour, Matt. I have so many more questions to ask, but so little time. But I really wanted to dig into the kind of publishing books and working on your iPad and all those sorts of things. I did promise the listeners not to talk about iPads on every single episode, but so far I've failed in that promise, so I'm a bad podcaster.
We just gently skirted the topic tonight, so I think that sort of counts as not talking about it.
Yeah, I'm a massive fan, Matt. I'm really looking forward to digging into book two, and definitely looking forward because it sounds a really exciting time to get involved in your books. Obviously, if you haven't already, dear listeners, you can follow Matt on Twitter. He is Matt Gemmell. We spelt it out for you before, but it's MATTGEMMELL. You're floating around Twitter almost all the time, Matt, in between obviously polishing off chapters.
And buying new games on the Switch, absolutely, yes.
And buying new games on the Switch. I'm definitely interested in signing up for this. I guess it's a Slack channel you get with your little Patreon thing, is it? Your membership?
That's right, yeah, we've got I think a Slack has kind of become a noun as well. We've got a Slack, yes, which has a whole bunch of channels within it. I'm not really sure what the nomenclature is there, but we do have that. We have some great chats about everything, as diverse as obviously stuff about the books and spoilers, philosophy, video games, of course, all kinds of things. It's really great fun.
Well, that sounds like my type of thing. For a bargain price of £4 per month, I'm in.
There you go. I'd love to see you there.
Right. Yep. If you want to join up, because I'm going to do that almost right now. Oh, I can pay with Apple Pay. It's almost too easy. It's like the Nintendo store all over again.
Low friction.
Head to mattgemmell.com, which is exactly the same as a Twitter. I'm not spelling it again. You can check out both of the books on there and obviously sign up to the membership if you so wish. But definitely sign up to the newsletter. To the letter, you'll get it's even every single one of those is signed by Matt, and it's feels very personal. But until next time, take care, my friends, and go buy some books.